bound by DNA, because CLN3 is certainly not a DNA-binding protein. So how this is working in a molecular sense is completely unclear. But as a formal description, it is a relatively reasonable description of what's going on. And it's a problem that's turned out that's been experimentally not terribly tractable. And again, but it doesn't bind. Yeah, it would be non-specific binding to the. Well, it could be specific, right? Because you know, it could be one side in the DNA. But I want to emphasize, this is not a DNA binding protein. Right? Well, if you experimentally mix it with DNA and separate the DNA from the protein at the end, there's DNA in one part and protein in t'other. But obviously inside the cell there could be all protein sorts of proteins bound to the DNA. It could bind to the spindle pole body. I mean, not very much. It's a hard protein to detect, so that probably means there are thousands of copies or less, not tens of thousands or millions. There are no stupid questions.
If you tell me it's a protein of cyclin, you're telling me anything useful about what it does or what its shape is? Or
it is telling both of those things. That's a very good question. So the cyclin-dependent kinases are a particular branch of the protein kinase family. They are the particular branch that bind the cyclins. The cyclins are all cyclins are related by homology and by structure and by function. That is, they have the family's big, and the minimal consensus that you would have to use to search a database is very degenerate, but it's actually still pretty effective at pulling out the right thing. Their structure is highly conserved, and they all bind to cyclin-dependent kinases and activate their protein kinase activity. Okay. However, not all of them fluctuate up and down during the cell cycle. So the first exemplar, the name was given to a band on a gel before it was a clone protein because it so obviously went up and down during the cell cycle. So not all cyclins fluctuate during the cell cycle. That's not entirely true. It's level. It has a very modest fluctuation during the cell cycle. So the somatic cell cycle should be held in contrast with the embryonic one, and I just wanted to remind you here of the thing that I said yesterday. So here's an egg about to be fertilized. This is what a regular cell looks like, and actually it would be basically an invisible dot here. So it is transformed into an egg by very slow growth over several months to make this cell that's a millimeter in diameter if you're a frog. And then after fertilization, you get these very rapid divisions, and they're rapid because all these cells are way above the threshold size, so that the engine is not restrained by size. And also, the analogy I sometimes like to use is that the regular cell cycle is like a VW bug. It's not particularly fast, but you know, it does the job. This is the drag racer of all cell cycles. So that these cell cycles basically have a simple alternation of DNA synthesis and mitosis. The doubling time is 30 minutes. The all-time record is held by Drosophila embryos, which have cell cycles as short as 8 minutes. And there is no regulation by any of the things that I set up there. Okay, so it is basically the stripped down cell cycle engine whipping around as fast as it can.
Is it roughly the same machinery that controls the embryonic?
Absolutely. Let me put it this way. There are lots of things in your bug that aren't in your drag racer, like the windshield wipers and more gears and stuff like that. So there are many components they have in common. The basic idea is exactly the same. The somatic cell cycle has extra bells and whistles built into it. Okay? But it's this, you know, it's the same mitotic cycle, and it's the same CDK1. Right? And it's one of the things that was very surprising to people. I mean, when I started working on the cell cycle, it's before large-scale cloning and sequencing of genes, and the cell cycle of yeast cells and the cell cycle of frog embryos looked remarkably different in terms of one of them being regulated in all these ways. The frog cell cycle very clearly has this autonomous oscillator. The yeast cell cycle looked very much like it didn't, because the cells could be stopped in all sorts of ways. And I think if you had asked people then how conserved the machinery that ran the two cell cycles was, they would have said, and this is not just embryonic and somatic, but this is like organisms whose last common ancestor lived a billion years ago, they would have told you that there was very little conservation, and the things might run according to entirely different mechanisms. And one of the big revelations in biology over the last 20 years has been just how strongly things have been conserved during evolution. And so, for example, you can replace the yeast CDK1 with the frog CDK1, and to a first approximation, things don't really look any different. So this is a protein whose structure and function has been sufficiently conserved over that billion years so that you can plug and play between different organisms.
I asked a question in some early models of the system posed that the system goes through a bifurcation and switching to the somatic cell cycle, where you have more of a oscillator or a switch between that is different than what looks like a lumen cycle in the embryonic.
Yeah, I think you can get the same components to do different sorts of oscillation, and you can put in breaks that require a break that has to be overcome in every cell cycle, which is true in the somatic cell cycle. But that's just adding components in. So this may get a little bit at your question. So things are slightly more complicated than I've drawn them. There are different cyclins. So there are cyclins that are expressed in G1. There are cyclins that have to do with controlling DNA replication. There are cyclins that have to do with mitosis. And for example, in the early frog cell cycle, the activity, the S phase cyclin, and the CDK that it's complex to is absolutely flat through the cell cycle, which is not true of a somatic cell cycle. Okay, but it's the same components. And there are different CDKs, so there's CDK1, CDK2, and there's a pair of related proteins called CDK4 and 6. In yeast, that's not true. In yeast, there's just CDK1. And these are respectively, this is the CDK that has the most to do with getting cells out of G1. This is the one that has the most to do with S phase. This is the one that has to do with getting cells into mitosis. CDK activity is regulated in a variety of different ways. The CDKs have to be phosphorylated in order to activate them. It occurs on threonine 167. As far as we know, this is not an important regulatory step. They can also be inhibited, and inhibition is dominant to activation in this case. That is, if both residues are modified, the inhibitory one wins. This occurs on tyrosine 15, and the phosphate is put on by WEE1, and it's taken off, which is a protein kinase. It's taken off by CDC25, which is a protein phosphatase, and they featured on that diagram about what different arrows meant. And there are also stoichiometric inhibitors of the CDKs. There are three principal ones in animal cells called P16, P21, and P27, which again primarily affect different CDKs. And there are a couple in yeast, which I'll say a little more about.
Stoichiometric inhibitor means you only inhibit as much as the amount of P16 put in.
You got it. You make a ternary complex CDK cyclin inhibitor, and the structures of some of this have been solved. What this means is that the CDKs actually act as very effective points to integrate information from all sorts of different pathways. Because many of these things, for example, these inhibitors their expression can be induced by different. The promoters of these genes themselves act as points of integration, and the half-lives of these proteins are controlled. So you can imagine all sorts of different regulatory inputs funneling down on one point, which is the formation and activity of CDK cyclin complexes. And as you pointed out, in your fancier growing somatic cells, you control the transcription as well as the translation and half-life of the cyclins. Okay. So here is a diagram with more of the bells and whistles. Okay. So this is the budding yeast cell cycle. And the mammalian one is in some general sense similar to this, but not nearly as well worked out. So we start at the beginning of the cell cycle with naked CDK1. The yeast version of CDK1 was originally known as a protein called CDC28. So if you read the literature, you'll actually see this name most of the time. It binds to G1 cyclins, of which CLIN3 is one of three different G1 cyclins, any one of which is sufficient to keep cells alive. And the G1 cyclins, or the complex they form with CDK1, catalyzes the phosphorylation of the G1 cyclins themselves plus other things. And that phosphorylation makes these proteins targets for another proteolytic machine, this one called SCF. And SCF don't stand for useful enough things for me to be able to remember them. Okay. And then as these things are getting degraded, the mitotic cyclins are being made, and they bind to CDK1, and that activity induces both S phase and mitosis, but induces S phase faster than it induces mitosis. And then the regulation of this is all very complicated. So you have to get out of mitosis, you have to destroy the cyclin. Okay? You do that by regulating APC activity, except there are two different forms of the APC. One is associated with an obligate activator called CDC20, and one is associated with an activator which is variously known as CDH1 or HCT1. And there is also a CDK inhibitor called SYK1. So when the cells are in mitosis, CDK1 inhibits the activity of SYK1, and it inhibits the activity of this form of the APC. It stimulates the activity of this form of the APC, which is in fact dependent on CDK1-dependent phosphorylation. So this initiates cyclin destruction. But you want to make sure that cyclin destruction keeps going for a long time, because in fact you need this window here where there is no CDK1 activity in order to assemble the complexes that are going to ultimately cause DNA replication in the next cell cycle. So it's important to have a window where there's no CDK1 activity. If you relied on this form of the APC, you can't guarantee this window, because as soon as the cyclin disappears, this form of the APC gets turned off. So the red lines mean on and the black lines mean off. However, this form of the APC then comes on because it's been inhibited by phosphorylation of HCT1 here. Okay? So it's now going to be active over this big, broad period of G1, and G1 constitutes a large fraction of the budding yeast cell cycle. Likewise, SYK1, which doesn't exist as long as CDK1 is active, because the active form of CDK1 phosphorylates this protein and triggers its destruction. As soon as the mitotic cyclins go away, this protein becomes stable and it persists for a long time. So now the cell cycle is stuck in G1. But we don't want it stuck there forever. So when the G1 cyclins get made, or when they accumulate to sufficient levels, because they activate CDK1, they turn off SYK1 by catalyzing its destruction, by catalyzing its phosphorylation, which leads to its destruction. And they phosphorylate HCT1, which turns off this form of the APC. Okay? And a couple of little things are diagrammed more clearly. So getting out of mitosis involves mutual antagonism between CDK1 and these proteins here, SYK1 and HCT1, and also a protein called SWY5, which is a transcription factor which induces the synthesis of SYK1. So SYK1 activity is being controlled at two levels. Its level is being controlled transcriptionally, and its level is being controlled by controlling the half-life of the protein. All these proteins are turned off, and interestingly, they're turned off in different ways by phosphorylation that's directly catalyzed by CDK1. So SWY5 is turned off because its phosphorylation evicts it from the nucleus, and since it's a transcription factor, it has to live in the nucleus in order to be active. SYK1 is turned off because its phosphorylation leads it to get degraded by this complex over here, SCF, which is active throughout the cell cycle. And HCT1 gets turned off because phosphorylation just makes it incapable of binding to the APC. As cells go out of mitosis, and this is one of the things that's not well understood, at least in the yeast cell cycle, CDK1 activates the CDC20-dependent form of the APC, and via intermediates that aren't particularly well understood, this turns on a phosphatase called CDC14, which does the opposite of what CDK1 does. And all these are examples of bistable systems where the two halves both inhibit each other. So once you start turning the wheel one way, it starts going faster and faster. And presumably it's true that you like things like that in the cell cycle because you want to make rapid transitions between states. You don't want to get stuck somewhere in limbo between them. And the last thing that's on this diagram is the transcriptional relationship between the mitotic and the G1 cyclin. So the G1 cyclins stimulate in a way that's not well understood but is clearly true. They stimulate their own transcription. They also stimulate the transcription of the mitotic cyclins. The mitotic cyclins stimulate their own transcription, but they turn off the transcription of the G1 cyclins. And that helps to mediate this switch that you see here. Okay? And it's all fabulously and wonderfully complicated. However, despite the tens of people years of work that went into that, everything is not completely understood. And there are some important missing links. The universal one, or at least the universal one that's glaringly obvious to me, is that you have to delay the CDK1-dependent activation of the APC, because if you didn't do that, you'd never be able to activate CDK1 with the mitotic cyclins at all, and you wouldn't be able to get into mitosis. So you have to activate on a short time scale. You have to turn on the mitotic activity of CDK1 on a short time scale, and you have to turn on the activity of the APC, which is going to inactivate CDK1 on a slower time scale. And there are a variety of different mechanisms that are responsible for that. One of those is the spindle checkpoint, which again I'll come back to, but that clearly is not the only mechanism, because at least in yeast cells you can remove the spindle checkpoint and the cell cycle keeps working. Another is that there, and this is recent work in frog eggs, there's an inhibitor of CDC20, which is this red thing, which is called EMI1. It binds to CDC20, keeping CDC20 inactive, thus keeping CDC20 from activating the APC, until it in turn has been phosphorylated by the active form of CDK1, which again triggers it for destruction. So this means there's basically a temporal lag built in to how fast you can activate CDC20 after you've activated CDK1. And finally, and none of these things are mutually exclusive, there's evidence that you need multiple phosphate groups, actually both on the APC and on CDC20, before this proteolytic machine becomes activated. And if you need lots of, and as long as these phosphorylation events are independent, that is the kinase has to dissociate between each phosphorylation event, this will give you a temporal lag. This, in principle, is not the most robust possible way of doing that. Here's another thing that's not well figured out, which is how CDC14, which I referred to on the last slide, is activated. And that's important for mitotic exit only in the budding yeast, because that's not a conserved feature. That's a sort of organism-specific modification of the cell cycle. But it's important for cell division in all eukaryotes. So that leads me to say a couple of words about modeling, because this has been a modeler's, you know, it's been a little mini modeling industry, and I actually spent a while in the early 1990s talking to a very good applied mathematician called Gary O'Dell about modeling, and I actually learned some stuff about limit cycles, which of course I immediately forgot. But so to me, there are three levels at which modeling can be done. So most of the modeling that's been done on the cell cycle is what I refer to as reality check. That is, you go talk to a biologist, the biologist tells you how they think it works. You see if you can find any position in parameter space where you get a limit oscillation out of things. And especially if you have to invent black boxes to get that to work, that seems to me to be something of limited utility. Because biologists are usually aware that it won't work exactly the way it's drawn, but that's because we know so little about how things work that we know that there are undiscovered components there. So it can be useful to say there is no way what you've drawn can possibly ever work as a limit oscillator, but then we have a tendency to go, okay, well, we'll tell us what we need and we'll go out and find those things.
Is that useful?
Yeah, it is useful, but I think it should mostly be done in private. Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess the problem. There's a bit of a cultural disconnect in the sense that in lots of systems where people model things, but they start with a world that they know, either because it's a world that's been very extensively studied, or because it's objects that don't exist in space, like self-organized criticality, which I, you know, from talking to someone yesterday afternoon, I now actually know what that is. But probably shouldn't be quizzed on it. And so in that sense, modeling is a very rigorous thing to do. But when you're talking about something where so much is unknown, as it is in many biological systems, it's useful to be able to say, well, you can't just have CDK1 being activated at the same rate as it activates the APC, because it would all collapse to a steady state. But actually, a surprising number of biologists haven't enough intuitive grasp of kinetics to know that that's true, and their response is, yeah, well, of course it doesn't work that way, it's way more complicated, we just haven't figured out what the other things are. So if the modeling makes predictions that are you know, qualitatively different, or this behaves exactly the wrong way, or it predicts surprising behaviors, then that's useful. I mean, what happened when Odell and I sat down and did this, and I guess we did do it in private because we never published it. You know, he was very frank with me. He said, you know, there's a tremendous number of unconstrained variables here, and this is not the way I like to do modeling, although I thought it would be fun to try. And I said, you know, sort of me too. And he said, but there are some predictions that aren't totally what you'd expect. So I went back to my students and postdoc, and I said, hey, anyone want to try testing this prediction? And one person in the lab, someone who's an extremely skilled experimentalist, said, yeah, this is pretty interesting. However, he had, in the end, a lot more things that he was interested in doing. So while he was always interested in it, never percolated up to the top of the list. And I guess it goes back to the thing about having tight connections between experiments and theory, and trying to get theorists to come to biology labs and do experiments, and trying to get biologists to learn enough of very simple simulation tools to do a little bit of modeling so that it can be a vicious instead of a virtuous cycle. So I'm not I think it's great to rule hypotheses out or to say this can't be as simple as you think it is. But I don't think it justifies the numbers of papers. I mean, there is an unbelievable number of papers that have been published about modeling the eukaryotic cell cycle, many of which I've had to review. And And I just, I mean, you know, people discover some more molecules, and the people who do the modeling go back and they make this year's version. And it's just not clear to me that we've learned that much, except that we are asymptotically approaching the point where the gaps in the cycle are closed. But at least for me, I feel like we qualitatively knew that anyway. And
but you may be speaking to an audience who would appreciate exactly the point you're trying to make and are willing to do it right.
Yeah, great. Well, that's why I'm saying this. I'm all for modeling. The reason I'm spending a week here is because I think there should be stronger links between theory and experiment in biology. But I think it's also important to you know, there's doing it right and. Well, I don't know. I mean, that's a question. So a second level that you could do things, well, possibly you should ask, you know, you should say, well, are there other systems that we should model, or, should we find experimentalists? I mean, there are people who, I mean, I guess part of the problem is what happens with biologists is they get to the point where they sort of understand it in principle. This sort of intuitive grasp of things, which actually is often very unsatisfactory and is often wrong too, which is very important to point out. But then again, you know, fashion tends to move on, right? So, you know, figuring out how the cell cycle engine works is a much less sexy topic than it used to be because most people think it's figured out, which is very unfortunate. There are people who are still committed to it. So one argument is that theorists who are interested in modeling the cell cycle should track those people down and try and make as tight as possible an interaction between the two sides.
Has there been any example where used to modeling
Hodgkin-Huxley is fantastic. It's a fantastic example. I think Leibler's work on chemotaxis, I think, is an example. You know, really, I mean, but that was an example where they modeled things and thought things, and then they pushed and did experiments. So there are examples. There aren't very many. I mean, I think in evolutionary theory, I mean, I think, you know, John Maynard Smith made huge contributions by showing that game theory was a useful way of thinking about evolutionary biology. So I think there are examples. But yeah, I agree. I mean, I guess maybe the point I'm trying to make is it's not like shooting fish in a barrel. But it's also, I'm all for it, because, you know, unlike modeling, you know, traffic flows and things like that, where, you know, there's fantastic data there and you can make simple assumptions and they're justified, biology is really complicated, and so it's hard work for both sides. I just think it requires much closer dialogue. Yes?
How many are there?
Well, it's a number that's not much bigger than this. I mean, the number of things. I mean, it's an interesting thing, an exercise I occasionally indulge in, is just to sit down with fellow biologists and ask, how many systems do you think there are that are understood, both qualitatively really well and a level where even semi-quantitatively you could model them and it would make sense to do them because people have measured rate constants and things like that. I guess that's probably true of action potential propagation in simple nerve cells. It's true of bacterial chemotaxis. It's true of phototransduction in rod cells in the vertebrate eye. It's true-ish of bacteriophage lambda and the switch between lysis and lysogeny. There are a couple of other candidates that people have brought up. It certainly doesn't get to the end of the fingers of two hands. It's very small, right? Because the problem is that, you know, if you want to do it really seriously and you want to know rate constants, that's hard. I mean, that's hard biochemical work. Well, there are plenty of, I mean, there are plenty of systems. There's an almost infinite number of systems that people could work on. I mean, you know, you could argue, I mean, the Delbruck argument would be that Max Delbruck has been gone for so long that people, you know, he basically forced people to work on a very small number of phage so that, you know, people's data was directly comparable and to each other's, and it was useful, and you could build up an understanding of things, despite, I mean, I guess with the exception of one of our audience, you know, that's not quantitatively particularly successfully modeled, right? The development of the well, you could talk about it, right?
Why is the biologist for modeling this? Just to have the satisfaction that the kinetic constant eventually produces the result. I mean, Huxley's contribution is not great, contribution is not the kinetic model, the details of that.
No, because it tells you how the system works. Yeah, and so I think what biologists tend to do is they do that in their minds in this rather idiot savant way, and I think good biologists are actually pretty good at doing it, but they can't tell you why it feels right a particular way. And I think it's very nice to have the reality check, you know, and I've learned how to use some of the very simple simulation programs, and it's very nice to say, well, okay, if I put these things in, does it, you know, do I get a limit cycle out? And then you know, well, it could work this way. So, oh, yeah.
No. Have some incomplete model.
Absolutely.
Some useful thing and it can be refined.
Absolutely.
Well,
I guess I'd love to talk to you guys about how to do that, right? Because that seems to me the interesting question, which is, I mean, what I would like to see models do much more of. I mean, the two useful things, I guess that's why I'm sort of going through this list. The first level is reality check for your particular model. The second one is a robustness check, right? So if it were true, which is a very debatable proposition, the biological systems tended to be robust, you might be able to test competing models, even very incomplete models where you have black boxes, just testing patterns of connectivity by testing their robustness in parameter space. And the most interesting possibility is that modeling can be a discovery mechanism because it can either discover parameters or properties of systems that are undiscovered. And I guess, you know, that, I mean, the more we go, the further down we go, the happier I as a biologist get. And I just want to throw out one idea about parameters. So measuring rate constants is A, difficult, and there's not a high throughput way of doing it. And B, you measure them outside cells, and the relevance of those measurements to what's going on inside cells is always questionable. And one possibility is that, again, making the very questionable assumption that biological systems are robust, you can describe the reaction parameters as some multidimensional space, and presumably there's an island within which the system works. In a multi-dimensional island. And in the center of that island, the system's maximally robust. So you could argue that you could divine the rate constants, at least the relative rate constants, not the absolute ones, presumably, by doing that sort of analysis. And that, for example, seems to me like it would be an interesting, again, if a group of physicists and biologists could agree on a system to work on, to try that as an exercise to say, okay, I'm going to make this prediction based on the idea. And so the biologists would try and test the system was robust. The physicists would assume it was robust and look for the maximally robust point in the phase space. And they'd say, okay, this is what the relative rates of all the reactions are to each other. And the biologists wouldn't go out and measure all of them, but they'd go out and try and measure some of them. And there are fluorescence-based ways, and there probably will be more in the future, of measuring reaction rates inside cells. Which you know, then you don't have to worry about this whole relevance thing. And I think that's an exciting direction to possibly go in. And obviously, you know, the most interesting idea is that you could make sort of a suite of models for some process, test them, have some sort of test like a robustness test or something else that would evaluate who the good and who the bad actors were, and some of the good actors would tell you, would make predictions that were very unexpected, and you'd go off and test them and you'd learn a lot about biology. And I think getting, and presumably that's happened in the bootstrapping between experimental and theoretical physics, and one of the things that I'd like to see is much more of that sort of going around the loop interaction with biology.
But what tells you which property of the system is robust, which is not? I mean, not every property of the system is robust.
So I'll give you an example for pheromone signaling, which we may or may not get to. And in that case, I would argue the robust thing is the mating frequency.
Is that something that you know experimentally?
I bet you a case of whiskey. Because that's what the function of the pathway is. It's to help cells mate, right? That's what it's there for. So presumably that's the thing that should be robust to perturbations, and that some of the intermediates on the pathway, their level doesn't necessarily have to be. And I was having lunch with Chin Lin and talking about it. I mean, that's something where one can experimentally test, because let's get back to the pheromone signaling pathway, because I can tell you how I think you could experimentally start to test that in a rather, you know, possibly a decently rigorous way. Do you want to do pheromone signaling now? Do you want to take a break? How do you want to?
10 minutes break.